when you think of a car as being a giant IT device, then you can start applying some of those same techniques to the car that you would apply to any other piece of major equipment.
In our first several episodes, we've had one-on-one chats with people working on different aspects of autonomous vehicles and the future of transportation generally. On today's show, we're mixing it up and trying a three-way conversation. Think of it like a carpool conversation about the future of cars.
I came to this a little bit circuitous. I started out life actually being mostly involved and interested in mathematics. My whole goal in life was to get a PhD in mathematics and teach college-level math and be an academic person and move on with that. And I kind of reached a point after, 8 years of university that I needed a little bit of time off. And during that little bit of time off, I took a temporary job at Lockheed Martin doing what turned out to be embedded software development for those of you who have been around as long as Scott has, one of the Star Wars projects that was a big deal during the Reagan administration.
That's Rob Bates. He's Chief Automotive Safety Officer for Mentor, based in the Silicon Valley. Rob's been around the embedded software world for decades. And since software likely is the biggest technical challenge facing autonomous vehicles and mobility services, I figured we'd get Rob's take. He didn't disappoint. Maybe it's because he used to teach college math and did well in speech and debate in high school. He's a regular at industry conferences for us, too. We're also talking to Scott Salzwedel. Scott's a fellow Mentor writer, and I hope will join me in co-hosting some of these episodes and producing some of his own, too. He and Rob go way back. Scott also knows his way around Southeast Michigan. He used to work at an ad agency with some of the big car companies as clients. Way back when, Scott did a writing project for one of the bigger names in the American auto industry. Now he wants to ask Rob about the relative merits of Python and C++ and embedded systems. Anyway, Scott's the other voice you hear today.
So we had Lincoln Mercury, and that was Y&R, Young and Rubicam. And Ford was handled by J. Walter Thompson. So yeah, I wrote a couple letters for Bill Ford, some sales letters. And very young in my career, and got some encouraging news. And yeah, I really enjoyed it. And so I guess automotive way back in the 80s, if I dare date myself.
Rob speaks often on safety and security related topics. The two ideas are often bound up together in chatter about what's going on in transportation. Check it out. Go to Google News and type in safety, security, autonomous. I guarantee you'll find a whole bunch of recent articles, no matter when you're listening to this. Of course, the two ideas are actually pretty distinct. We asked Rob to break it down for us a bit, starting with security, a topic he knows quite well.
I guess, Rob, the one thing is since we're on the topic of security, how do we secure transmission, like data at rest, data in use, and once it gets transmitted? What kind of steps can software engineers, developers take to secure their data on the edge?
So basically, the concept of security in automotive is relatively new. You know, automotive software and automotive systems have always been focused on safety. And because those systems have traditionally been mostly closed, closed in the sense of, you know, the connections to the outside world were very, very closely held and very kind of requiring physical connections, like through a debug port or something like that, that security wasn't really even a thought in our friends in automotive. That's becoming more and more of an issue as cars become more and more connected to the rest of the world. And so the kinds of things that Scott, that you asked about are really kind of new to the automotive world, but fortunately are better understood in the IT world. And when you think of a car as being a giant IT device, then you can start applying some of those same techniques to the car that you would apply to any other piece of major equipment.
Sure. I'm just blown away by when we talk about automotive, we have vehicle-to-vehicle communication, we have vehicle-to-infrastructure communication, and now all of a sudden we have vehicle-to-cloud. So it just seems so overwhelming.
It is. And the other problem is that the technologies that are needed for infrastructure haven't really caught up to the technologies for autonomous drive. You mentioned vehicle to vehicle and vehicle to infrastructure communication. The industry calls that, you know, V2X or vehicle to anything. And those technologies are, let me give an analogy. Let's say that you want to build up your smart house and you buy some smart light bulbs and you buy a smart doorbell and you hook up your stereo system and all of these to these smart things. And if you just do that, then chances are pretty good that they don't talk to each other and they don't talk through a common interface. Right? You have to...
They just talk up to the cloud, or they talk...
They talk up to the cloud.
To some central location.
Yeah, they talk up to the cloud, and then they talk down to an app, a dedicated app that sits on your cell phone. Right? So your watering application is a different application from your doorbell application, which is different than anything else. And that's kind of where we are... That's where we risk going in the short run with the vehicle. You know, everybody has their ideas about how all of these things should interact, but nobody has agreed as to how they should interact.
So you're kind of leading up to another question I had for you, and that's with SAE. They talk about the different levels of autonomous driving, correct?
Yes, they do.
There's the from zero all the way up to five. So we're kind of touching on that now. And I just find it interesting how there's this mad race for certain OEMs to claim they have level three when, in fact, they're not quite there yet. But because of marketing, because of competition, they want to be the first out of the gate. And I just wonder if that's, in the long run, if that's going to hurt us, if the perception around autonomous driving is going to get knocked a couple, you know, notches down because the OEMs themselves are sort of misleading the public.
So
I don't know. Do you agree with that?
Well, that's opening up whole cans of worms. I will say that, based on the SAE definitions, I think that level three is the worst possible place to be.
So can we, just for our listeners, can we describe level three?
Sure. Well, level one and two are basically driver assist features of the type that you see in cars today. You know, can the car help you stay in the lane? Do you have adaptive cruise control? Those kinds of things that make driving the car easier, that the companies today use to help sell cars. And those are really valuable technologies because the driver is still completely engaged, but the car is helping him and giving them more information on how to stay safe in the car.
Okay.
And levels four and five are really kind of more truly autonomous, right? Level four is, we're autonomous most of the time unless something goes wrong, and we'll give a warning to the driver, hopefully in time for them to do something about it. And then level five is that kind of Jetsons level future where you've got the car with no steering wheel, no pedals, no nothing. You get in the car, it takes you where you want to go, done. Okay. Level three is like what Tesla Autopilot is capable of doing, where it will drive autonomously most of the time, and it will do it pretty well. You know, it for the most part, it gets you where you want to go. You don't really have to think about it, and it's fine, except that it ignores the human problem in that, okay, if I'm in that car and I'm doing, autopilot, the very first time I do that, I'm going to sit there in the driver's seat and I'm going to hold my hands either on or right above the wheel while the car is driving itself, because I don't trust that the car is going to respond the way that I need it to respond so that I don't get, in an accident. The fifth time I do that, you know, I might be watching a movie. Because I have done this now several times. Nothing bad has happened. The mind wanders, right? And they can add features that basically annoy you to trying to pay attention to the road. You know, but it doesn't solve the basic problem that if you're saying that the human is still in control, even though they're not, it's just bad human engineering.
Okay, so let me throw this at you. So we're talking level three. I read recently where Volvo is going all the way to level. They're not even going to do a level two, three, four. They're going to go right to five because their thinking is we don't want to have somebody, develop these bad habits at level three. It's best just to go straight to level five, and that's safer, cleaner, That's interesting that Volvo would do that.
I agree with them, by the way. I think that that is the only way to go that makes sense. You either have driver assist features of the type we were talking about before that everybody has today.
And sure. Like basic one, maybe a two level.
Right. You know, I think that's fine. You know, my next car, it will be chock full of those features. My wife just bought an electric car that is chock full of those features. You know, and then the next step really should be full autonomy, which is what Volvo is doing.
Yeah. For that just sort of makes sense because this intermediate stage, you know, multiple stages that we have, we're going to learn bad habits or the trust or I don't know. It just seems we're going to fall into some situations that we can't get out of.
Right. I think that's
but anyway.
No, and I think that's true. But I think that. Well, maybe this is another question that you have that you'll have, but I think that there is that the risks. Let's just say that the risks that a company like Volvo is taking on are partially technical, but the biggest risks are not technical. The biggest risks are societal and social,
like human behavior kind of stuff.
Yes, human behavior and human reaction.
So, Rob, I know you've been sort of an evangelist talking about functional safety for automotive, for Mentor, and maybe just to back up and level set on some terms, certainly if you read press about what's happening in automotive generally and with self-driving in particular, you see safety and security mixed up all the time. But in fact, as I got to know working with you a while back, those are two sort of fundamentally different topics. What is, as an engineer thinking about building a car, what is safety and what is security?
So that's a pretty broad question. When we talk about safety in an embedded device or safety in terms of software, what we're talking about is has the system considered things that can go wrong, you know, hazards. And if in the consideration of those hazards, does the system respond in an appropriate way when those hazards occur? So a simple example is, you know, let's say that your self-driving car detects that it no longer has control over steering the car. That would be a fairly significant problem. And so there just needs to be some kind of mechanism, a safety mechanism is what we call it, that says this is what we do when we detect this anomalous behavior. And in the world, maybe 15 or 20 years from now, where we have, you know, full autonomous vehicles along with good vehicle-to-vehicle communication, the right answer might be to just slow down and stop the car as efficiently as possible if you can't steer it anymore. A simpler kind of problem might be, well, let's say that you ran over something and you broke, you know, you broke a tire and maybe your wheel is compromised. Then maybe what you want to do is you just want to slow down and pull off to the side of the road and stop. Right. So you think about these hazards. You think about what you can do to mitigate those hazards, and then you make sure that you go ahead and implement those mitigations as completely as possible. The other thing that you think about a lot is more what I would just call fundamental quality. You know, we think of failures in any safe system as having two basic forms. They're what we call systemic failures and then what we call random failures. Systemic failures are really simple. They're bugs. They could be software bugs. They could be hardware bugs. They could be any kind of bug. But they're the kind of thing that once you know that you're there and once you know how to trigger them, you can reproduce them pretty simply. Now, a lot of times in embedded software, actually figuring out what the cause is and figuring out how to reproduce them might be difficult. But the concept's pretty simple. You have a bug, and one of the whole points of software development for safe systems is how do you limit bugs as much as possible? And then the same thing would be true for hardware. Okay. So from a safe perspective, that's what we're doing. Does the system behave in the way that it's supposed to when something goes wrong? And is the system designed and developed in such a way to limit the kinds of things that could go wrong that you may not have considered in that macro environment? Security is similar, but has a different focus, right? In security, what we're concerned about are things like, is the system able to respond appropriately if it is exposed to external behaviors that would not be considered to be part of normal operation? And that could be anything from like a dedicated denial of service attack. It could be a physical intrusion into the system. It could be, any number of things that are not kind of part of the standard operation of the system itself. And then when we talk about building a secure system, what we're trying to understand is, well, how can these attacks occur? And what can I do to protect myself when those attacks occur? The interesting thing about security is that you're always behind. The bad guys are always trying to figure out how to get in to a system. And, we're human beings. We can't think of every possible conceivable way to get into a system. I mean, if you look at things like Apple and Google Android, who have spent literally thousands and thousands of man years trying to secure their system. And then you hear about, but the bad guys just found a new, what they call zero-day attack.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Yeah.
So the bad guys are always ahead. So part of being secure is not just, did we try to protect ourselves as much as possible? But part of it is the response. What do we do when we find out that something we didn't think about is now there?
So, Scott, you want to ask a question about broad standards and autonomous driving in general?
Well, sure. We had touched on this earlier, and it's all about communication, data transmission. And we had talked about vehicle to vehicle and vehicle to infrastructure and even vehicle to cloud. We also had mentioned Tesla Autopilot. So my question, Rob, and it seems to me that we have the OEMs coming out with their own AV onboard assistance, autonomous vehicle assistance. For example, Autopilot from Tesla. There's the personal co-pilot from BMW. So my question is, are these systems going to be able to talk to each other when it comes to vehicle-to-vehicle? And are they going to come together at some point, or are we going to sooner or later have a problem with each manufacturer doing their own thing when it comes to transmitting data between vehicle and up to the cloud?
I hate to be flippant, but I think the answer is yes. And let me explain a little bit. So right now with today's technology, and with today's level of standardization, these vehicles will not be talking to each other. Like right now, let's take a simpler example. If I have, like right now today, I have a limited version of vehicle to infrastructure communication. And it's built into your GPS, right? Your GPS gives you quote unquote real-time traffic updates, right? So basically what that is there are road sensors. The road sensors transmit information, to a central clearinghouse through the cloud. And then that information is then re-encoded into the GPS data. And then your GPS unit displays what it knows as real-time traffic. There are other ways of doing it. I think older systems use FM, even to do this. So, you know, there's lots of ways to skin this to deal with this. But the point is that it's quote unquote real time, right? When it says that there's a slowdown, chances are there was a slowdown at least within the last 10 minutes or so. But it's not real time enough to really help us with autonomous drive. And right now, the fastest way we could, in theory, communicate between cars on the road is through 4G. Now, I don't know how your experience with 4G, or sorry, it's with LTE, not 4G. Now, I don't know what your experience is with LTE, but my experience with LTE is that it's okay, but it's not nearly speedy enough just to download the data for my apps. Okay.
And it can be spotty.
And it's really spotty. I was on the phone today with a partner from Germany at my home in Burlingame, which is part of the Bay Area, which is one of the highest technologically advanced areas in the world. And I live like 15 miles south of San Francisco, and I have really lousy cell phone coverage. So go figure. But anyway, so what has to happen is a number of things. We need better and faster communication backbone, which will probably be 5G. But 5G is a while away. We need everyone to agree as to how these things will communicate, right? I mean, what's going to happen in the first generation is Tesla will have their own way of communicating. GM will have their own way. BMW will have their own way. And they'll kind of be based on kind of IP technology that we already kind of sort of understand, but they'll all be different because they're not going to wait long enough for everyone to sit down around a table and come to an agreement, right? Which is how ubiquitous connectivity happens, is everybody does their own thing, and then basically your competitors get together and they sit around a table and they hash out something that will work for all of them, and then that's what they do with extensions. And that's how the internet has evolved since the 60s, and it's not going to change. And so 10 years from now, there probably will be agreements, and then that will then enable that more direct vehicle-to-vehicle, vehicle-to-infrastructure communication using some kind of faster over-the-air network like 5G.
So it's just like a natural progression of things.
Right. It's a natural progression of things, but it's going to be kind of ugly when it starts. And, you know, it may be that the first generation of cars won't even have the right hardware, even though if it is based on mostly existing technology, it's probably something that can be handled with both software updates and maybe like a recall type hardware update. You know, you replace your 4G with your 5G, you download a new software load. Maybe that's all that's necessary, but no one knows what will be required because no one knows what it will look like.
So are all these OEMs going to be using NVIDIA as their hardware?
Well, NVIDIA would like them to.
Yeah.
Intel would like them to use Mobileye.
Sure.
You know, my guess is that much like if you look at a different market that is somewhat related, right? Look at the graphics market for just your PC. You know, at this point, right, there are small boutique vendors, but there's two vendors, right? There's NVIDIA and there's ATI, which is owned by Intel. Or they're owned by, I think it's Intel. They're owned by somebody, and that's it. Right. And they provide similar interfaces so that if I'm building an application, I don't really care. And Microsoft then provides abstractions that also means I don't care. So we will eventually get there, just like we talked about at the very beginning of all of this, where, you know, companies like Wind River and other companies in the embedded space made it possible for users not to care too much about the hardware, except for that very small number of old gray-haired embedded software developers who are responsible for hooking it all together. The same thing will ultimately happen here. We will define these interfaces, we will standardize those interfaces, and then everyone will just use those interfaces and not really think about the underlying mechanisms that they invoke, except for a small number of gray-haired guys who have to maintain it.
And that's how we get to level 5.
And that's how we get to level 5. And actually, we might get to level 5 like for like platooning, right? Which is a which is basically like a caravan of autonomous trucks.
Which is happening right now, right?
Yeah, I was reading an article, like a week and a half ago, that was talking about the possibility of platooning might be just as simple as, you know, take half a dozen autonomous trucks and line them up behind a human-driven truck. And all the platooning trucks have to do is stay in a line behind the human-driven truck. And if they can figure out a way to do that so that me as a driver doesn't try to get in between them, you're golden. Yeah, right. But that of course is the hard part. We're going to have some very interesting occurrences that happen while we're making this transition. You can envision 20 years in the future where basically just about everything is autonomous and vehicle to vehicle communication, and that's fine. And we can envision today where everything is human driven and people are as safe as they are. But there's going to be a point where autonomous vehicles are part of it, and human-driven vehicles are part of it, and that's going to be fascinating.
Every guest on the show gets a series of rapid-fire questions near the end. So think here of a real-time operating system, which is a big deal in embedded software. You know, this is a kind of OS that processes data and serves up applications with no buffer delays. So here's Rob in real-time, with no buffer delays.
So again, Rob, this is just like ask all the guests one or two sentence responses off the top of your head only. So number one, what's your favorite go-to source of information about autonomous vehicles in general? Who do you read? Who do you watch? What do you recommend?
There's so many. Google. Google's amazing. You ask it a question, it gives you answers. But more seriously, I follow SAE pretty closely, Society for Automotive Engineers. There are many different subgroups that are focusing on aspects of autonomous drive, and there's a wealth of information there. For AI in general, the NREC, which is run out of Carnegie Mellon, the National Robotics Engineering Center, has a lot of information and can point you to a lot of other information. And then just in general, you know, for AV, there are a lot of blogs out there. I do follow the Driverless Car Market Watch, which is driverlessfuture.com. They're pretty optimistic, but they're comprehensive, and they can point you to a lot of other sources that are kind of interesting.
Okay, Rob, what's your favorite RTOS and why?
What is my favorite RTOS? Well, you know, I guess I would have to go with – no, I won't go there. You know,
careful.
most commercial RTOSes today are equivalent in terms of functionality. And so whether you use VxWorks or whether you use Integrity or whether you use Nucleus, which is Mentor's own real-time operating system, from a functionality standpoint, it's pretty commodity. You know, where companies differentiate themselves, unless it's really kind of a low-lying price thing, is expertise, support, and services. And so, you know, if you're really looking for an RTOS, those are the things that you should look at. You know, the other thing is that there are much like with Linux, you know, it used to be when I was started in this industry a long time ago, Linux was a thing you never thought of for embedded. And the reason that you didn't is you needed a server class system to run it.
Yeah, it was just kind of large and took lots of memory.
Yeah, and it is still large, and it still does require a lot of memory. But the community has done a lot of work to speed it up. But what's more important is that the hardware is so much faster and has so much more memory and is so much less expensive that, you know, we used to talk about real time as being the most important thing. And for certain automotive applications, it is. You need guaranteed, you know, 10 millisecond or 10 microsecond, depending upon the application response, right? And Linux isn't going to give you that. But in a lot of applications, fast enough is good enough. And so it's not really real time in that hard deterministic real time kind of sense, but it's plenty fast if you put a plenty fast enough processor on it. And that's where a lot of the embedded world is going.
Okay, so Rob, for the longest time, we've talked about multi-OS architectures that encompass both deterministic RTOS, and then the more general functional Linux application. So are you seeing that in the automobile, the clusters, for example, where you need to?
So let me give you a specific example. We are working with a large car manufacturer who is planning on delivering autonomous vehicles, or at least, you know, at least for freeway use in the next few years. And their underlying architecture, if you look at the operating system level, is going to look something like exactly what you're just described. Is it's going to be running Linux for the really kind of heavy lifting AI applications, you know, the targeting, all of those kinds of things that just require a full featured operating system with lots of I/O. And then it will also have a deterministic RTOS for those aspects that need to be done within some kind of cyclic control loop. And using the same kind of techniques that we generally talk about in those kinds of applications, either hypervisor or hardware separation or those kinds of things, are just as important in that application as they are in, say, a medical device where your screen is running Linux, but your life-altering functions have to be run in a much more tightly controlled environment.
When we can talk about who that customer is, we want to have you back on for further discussion.
It's gonna be a while.
All right, I'm pulling us back to the rapid fire stuff. So number two, what advice do you have for someone who might want to get into automotive systems engineering today, and specifically to work on autonomous vehicles?
So, you know, the answer to that just kind of depends upon where you are in your career. If you're, you know, if you are a recent grad and you're trying to figure out what kind of course of study to follow, you know, then something like AI or robotics at a place that is that's kind of in the forefront of those kinds of things, like University of Michigan or Carnegie Mellon or Georgia Tech, would set you up perfectly. Okay. But if you were listening way at the beginning of this, I didn't come from any of that, right? I mean, my degrees are in mathematics. My experience is in just general embedded software. And so take your relevant experience and the kinds of things that you have, your existing skills, and learn about the industry, learn about the problems that they're trying to solve. Maybe do, you know, MIT does all kinds of things online that can kind of help give you the basics that you need to be able to talk the language and understand what they're doing, and use your experience to then kind of forge a path, right? It's what I've done. It's what a lot of people have done. Nobody more than 5 years ago started out with a lot of AI experience, right? Nobody has a lot of autonomous drive experience. Right. So the field is wide open, and it's going to be bright people, engaged people who have at least some of the right experience and who understand the mind space, who can then go in and help us solve these problems.
My final question for Rob is C++ or Python?
neither. No. I mean, okay. Yeah, I'm a big fan. You know, languages don't matter. At the same time, certain languages help you do certain things better than others. So C++ has some advantages. I actually would prefer, if I'm going to write in a C style language for a system, I'll probably write it in C. Python is good for a lot of things. I don't know that these kinds of algorithms are one of them. I would probably use an AI focused language.
Is it just me, or is Python the rage these days?
Python is very heavily used, but Python mostly replaces scripting languages. Or for things that need kind of quick insertion. So if you've got an operating environment that you want to have different logic that runs within that operating environment, then Python is well suited for that.
A big thanks to Rob Bates and Scott Salzwedel for having the discussion today. We'll include links to more information about both of them in the show notes. Rob has an overview video of our MentorSafe program for ISO 26262 compliance, where he riffs a bit more on the difference between safety and security, and also talks about what we're doing to help engineers comply with what may be the most important safety standard around these days. He's also got that paper on the challenge of functional safety given the rise of AI and cars that think and learn for themselves. We'll include links to both of those in the show notes. We've got more great discussions coming up, too. One with Puneet Sinha, a Penn State PhD who's at Mentor now doing all sorts of interesting work with thermal modeling of sensors and batteries. Also, I'll be talking with Marcus Welts and Priscilla Boyd at Siemens Intelligent Traffic Systems. Marcus is president of ITS and Priscilla is a senior product manager. ITS does all sorts of cool stuff with traffic management and smart infrastructure in cities around the world. We're going to get into how smart cities and connected cars are related to what's happening with autonomous vehicles. Thanks for joining us today, and for more, visit Siemens PLM Software online. Siemens PLM Software is a world-leading provider of product lifecycle management and manufacturing operations management software. We help thousands of companies realize innovation by optimizing their processes from planning and development through manufacturing, production, and support.